Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman.
And I'm Kiran Chetri. And this is Future Proof. So let me tell you about Future Proof. It's really all about the latest actionable information in marketing, technology, with an eye toward new trends, new insights that help keep you ahead of the competition.
So one of the things that Kiran and I are both very interested in is the future of healthcare and figuring out what it's going to look like in the years ahead. I think a lot of that's going to be really getting rid of a lot of the inefficiencies in the market.
We are happy to welcome the co-founders of RubiconMD. It's a company founded with the goal of helping primary care doctors help their patients faster, more effectively, and at a lower cost using technology. So here with us now, Gil Addo and Carlos Reynes. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
What I'm interested about, first of all, is that you guys are doing something really interesting, and you have the stats to prove it when it comes to trying to find a way to make it easier for patients to get access to specialists and to improve the process, really, because according to a lot of the statistics, almost 50% of the time, a primary care physician either A, gets it wrong, or B, sends you to something that's unnecessary. So tell us a little bit about your business model.
Yeah, so we started in 2013. We started off of an idea and a concept that emerged from some personal experience that I had. And the idea was, is there a way to export the expertise that sits in a lot of academic medical centers and hubs around the country out into the communities where it's necessary and where it's valuable? So I had a grandmother that was based in Barbados, and she traveled up to Boston for surgery on a brain tumor. And then she traveled back and forth over the course of a 5-year period for all the management and post-op thereafter. And so this idea was, is there a way to provide access out into communities to that expertise that sits at these large academic medical centers and other specialist hubs, which historically have been co-located geographically for good reason, but that expertise doesn't have to just sit there because we have technology and we have ways to get it out. That was the idea behind RubiconMD. What we do is really simple. You go see your primary care provider as a patient, and they'll use our platform, leverage our panel of specialists to get opinions in a couple hours. And those opinions will come back into the primary care provider, and they'll use it to follow up with the patient.
You gave an example in some of the literature that I read. So this doctor, and this woman takes her kid to an ER. She's very nervous that her daughter has an eye infection. The ER doctor thinks, oh man, this is probably just, you know, an infection with regular antibiotics. But he has some little inkling in him that thinks that maybe it could be worse. So he, utilizing your platform, the e-consult, sends out this blast with all the information, and ophthalmologist was there said, who picked it up said, oh my gosh. Is it optometrist?
They found out
that they had, that this girl actually had eye herpes, which is something that could potentially lead to blindness. And so tell us how this e-consult works and how that would streamline a situation like that.
Yeah, it's so this the setting where we at Valley is primary care. So this was a setting where a mom took her 3-year-old girl to her primary care doctor after she had a wound near her eye. And the primary care doctor looked at it and said, you know, it's a wound. I think this is the right treatment plan. I'm not as concerned, but I'm still going to do an e-consult with RubiconMD to get some additional insight from, in this case, they consulted with a dermatologist. They took a photo, uploaded it to RubiconMD, provided a brief description, and asked the dermatologist, what do you think this is? What are the treatment options that you would recommend? The dermatologist is someone a lot more specialized in this particular type of issues, figured out that this could be a herpes infection. And a herpes infection right next to the eye on a 3-year-old means a high risk of losing the eye. And what they did is they recommended a visit to the ER immediately so that they could be seen by an ophthalmologist. This patient happened to be a Medicaid patient, and the unfortunate reality is that Medicaid patients don't have a lot of access to specialists. They're typically looking at months of wait times. So for them, just waiting and going to a dermatologist wasn't a real option. But fortunately enough, they acted on this information, sent the kid to the ER. She was in immediately. They confirmed there was a herpes infection. Apparently, she was eating a lollipop, and she cut her face with a stick. That's how the infection went from the mouth to the eye. But they caught it in time. They started treatment immediately. There was no infection to the eye. And the primary care provider actually called us back and said, hey, guys, I want to bring this up to your attention. This was an awesome intervention where you helped me practice a lot better primary care and avoid a lot of complications for my patients. So the first time this happened, we were, like, blown away with what we just did. And then we've seen that every 150 e-consults that we do, there's one of these high-impact cases where we have avoid a lot of complications for our patients.
That's huge. I mean, I think just when I hear about this, I think, and I know you were saying about, you know, your grandmother, but how did you kind of realize, oh my God, this is a major problem that's worth solving and that there are all these people who are impacted because they don't have the right access to the right specialist at the right time?
So the business case that we were able to uncover for this is we started digging through the literature. We found that almost half of the things that go see specialists or that go to specialists could actually be handled by primary care providers. And when you start thinking about what that means for the system, the numbers get staggering and get large really fast in terms of things that are being sent to wrong specialists, things that are being started on care plans that don't need to happen, and all the kind of downstream impacts of people having to travel unnecessarily, people having to take days off from work.
It's the pay-for-service system that still exists, right? Doctors only make money when a patient physically is in their waiting room and physically in their office. There's been a lot of talk about whether, you know, you can make things easier, especially for patients that are dealing with very painful and, you know, difficult-to-travel illnesses like, you know, chemotherapy. And there still seems to be this reluctance on the part of insurance companies and others to cover alternative. And by that, I don't even mean, you know, Western versus Eastern medicine. I just mean alternative ways to get in touch with patients and have the doctor still get paid. Because if at the end of the day, the doctor can't get paid for his time and his work, he's not going to be able to stay in business. And we've seen that in a lot of areas, especially in rural areas in our country.
Yeah, and it's crazy. Somebody gave me an analogy that I really like. It's like if you went to the gym and you, instead of having a membership fee, you pay for every single like piece of equipment you touched.
Right.
And the time you did. So you spend 10 minutes on a treadmill, you pay for that, then you go to the, you know, to go to use a barbell, and you just keep using all that. Maybe you have to pay for one barbell, but you have to then pay for the other one. And so it's just the system.
And that's the analogy of what? Of what currently exists?
The system currently is right now. That's fee for service.
And what's interesting, though, is that, like, you go to a restaurant, and most places aren't all you can eat. So it's kind of like people are used to one paradigm in one environment, and then they're used to an entirely different pricing model in another.
Yeah, and the thing that makes healthcare so different, we believe that everybody has a right to healthcare, and it's a good that you want to make sure that people have access to. And because of that, you have to treat it as such, and you can't have this paradigm where you're paying for each barbell that you use. And so I think the good news is that things are moving in the right direction. I think there's a lot of excitement, and the reason we're here and doing the work that we're doing is because there is this broad shift to value-based care where you pay to provide great care and to keep people healthy, healthcare, keeping people healthy. And so I think it's really exciting. I actually think right now, a lot of the things that are happening, we've seen a lot of movements in California around legislation to provide what we call alternative touches, so to allow for things like e-consult. There's, say what you will about what's happening in D.C., there's bipartisan support broadly.
Nothing's happening.
Yeah, or what's not happening in D.C., but there's bipartisan support broadly for this shift to value-based care. And the thing that we say when people ask us about it, healthcare is almost 20% of the GDP. You can't continue to grow the top line. And so what you have to do is figure out how to do the same things better, faster, cheaper. And that's where digital health comes in. And so that's why you're seeing so much investment, so much excitement, so much attention to the things that we're working on. And so it's just an exciting time to be working on this stuff. And I think, yeah, I think it's great to be part of it.
Yeah, and I definitely want to get back to the California, because I think I have a question about that.
He wants to get back to it because they legalized marijuana for recreational use.
I'm
teasing.
I'm the one person who won't benefit from that. Everybody else I know.
Either.
But, no, I mean, so, like, broadly, what do you think that the future, like, let's expand the conversation a little bit. Like, what do you think that the future of healthcare looks like in general? And I know that that's broad, but I think what you're trying to do is solve one part of the problem right now, and I think there's so many different problems. So if you were going to make any, you know, predictions that nobody can hold you to 10 years down the line, what does it look like in the U.S. from a health perspective?
Yeah, so we chose to work on this specific problem very deliberately. We believe that the system needs to be transformed from primary care. You look at primary care now, it's probably about 5% of the total cost of care. But it's been proven that systems with a robust foundation of primary care actually achieve better outcomes. People live longer, there is less prevalence of chronic conditions, there is less infant mortality.
Well, that's if they have
strong healthcare base.
Yeah.
More investment in healthcare,
right.
More resources allocated to this, more people with established primary care. So that's the approach that works, and that's why we decided to develop a digital technology to support primary care providers do their job better.
So that brings me to my question about incentive. I mean, we all talk about, you know, what are the incentives to make this shift? And one of the things that a lot of doctors, primary care doctors that I've talked to, because I really am passionate about this affordable healthcare system, because, you know, what we're doing, it seems to make no sense to me that what we do is we wait until we're at crisis point. And, you know, ER is like the first time many, many people touch any aspect of medicine or care when it's already too late.
Right.
And one of the things that we talked about was incentivizing being healthy, right? So if you have a gym membership, you get a certain percentage off, you know. But you have to bring companies on board, because companies are not, you know, the government, in my opinion, sorry, the more bureaucracy, the more red tape, the longer it takes, they make more money. I mean, whereas businesses, they don't have that luxury. They can't just keep pulling, you know, adding to the national debt, because they're not going to have a business. So how do you incentivize companies to invest in this without, in my mind, some sort of public-private partnership, without some sort of way to incentivize it at the government level, where they either get some sort of tax break or some sort of seed money or something to give this a try?
So one of the things that we've heard a lot of people talk about is the build towards what they call interoperability. So having different systems to speak to each other. So allowing your electronic medical record to be able to speak to this system that would pull it, like Rubicon MD, that would pull information and share it with a specialist. And when it comes back, having a system that could then share it out as a patient portal to the patient.
Right. But there's reluctance to do that.
There's a lot of reluctance. And I bring it up as an example of a way in which government can create a framework to incentivize and then just allow, you know, companies and organizations like us to go forth and try to really solve these problems. Because we have a couple incentives. One is, obviously, we're a for-profit enterprise, so we want to do things that will generate value for our shareholders. But we also are a startup. And so, as a startup, time is our enemy. We want to do things as fast as possible. And so if you just kind of clear the runway, we're going to run as fast as possible there. And so I think the example that they create there the example of interoperability, where you essentially just create a framework and you say to large groups and electronic health record companies, you have to play ball. You have to allow these groups to connect and to pull information and push information back in. And you just create that framework, and then you penalize people who are bad actors. Rather than saying, this is how this thing connects to that thing, that's not the right way to do it. Here's the framework. And if you don't play ball and you don't work in a meaningful way, then, you know, we're going to penalize you. That, I think, is a structure that you want to create. And then you just have to let companies and organizations kind of move towards providing value to patients. And if you provide value to patients, theoretically, over time with the move to value-based care, the cream is going to rise to the top.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's always the theory, right? And yeah. I think that especially with startups, but it's interesting to me because you happen to be operating in this area where it's very difficult to move quickly because there's, you know, like all the bureaucracy, and right. You can move quickly, but you have to get buy-in from other parties. I mean, how do you typically cross those hurdles when you get to them?
Yeah.
One of you guys needs to date a congresswoman. That's what has to happen.
Yeah. I'll let Carlos be not to dating a congressman.
No, I'll take that. I'll let Carlos talk about that part.
To our experience with one particular or some of the systems that we've dealt with, which I think broadly speaking just is emblematic of what the challenge with healthcare, right? Healthcare is just going to move slower. But when you get there, when you get it right, and providing care, it looks great and it feels great, but we've had people come in from other industries that are shocked at the pace at which this moves, that calling it this is startup world, but it's a slower industry.
So how do you, I guess, get some buy-in from the government to try to say that, you know, there will be incentives for people who are able to prove, let's say, within a 5-year mark that they've substantially decreased the cost, not only to the patient, but to the system, to the government? It seems to me like that is really the challenge with startups like this, is nobody wants to be the first one to try this out. No one wants to be the first one to try out the car that has no steering or brakes. It's just automatic. Just hop on the road. But this is what's so stupid. This is, I know how to solve it exactly. If I were your congresswoman, I would say this: you get a tax abatement for 5 years, okay?
Yeah.
And anybody that buys in and tries it also gets a drastic reduction in their taxes to incentivize it. But no, they won't do that. I mean, healthcare is the number one priority for most people. And also, it is basically the hot potato that nobody wants to touch, because every time they have Obama, Hillary, anybody, it's proven to be politically disastrous.
Yeah. And I think that we say, okay, they're really big picture, you can't solve it from the top easily. So we said, let's solve it at the most micro level and then hope that it slowly scales in kind of concentric circles. So what we did was we went and we started with one small group. We had our first two customers. One of them was a group called Iora Health, based in Boston. They were fairly small at the time. They're now much larger. And they were just disrupting this with a model that just allowed you to do primary care really, really well. Take on risk, work with plans, provide an amazing experience, state-of-the-art offices. And we just started working with them at one site, and then we slowly scaled there. And then we learned how to build a platform in a largely forgiving environment and worked with them as a partnership. And we were able to basically scale with these groups that they looked really small at the start. Nobody paid attention to them. And then as they scaled, we scaled. And then we went to larger groups, and we went to regional health plans. And so when we got to these regional health plans in California and Texas, we had a solution that we knew could work in these Medicaid populations, and we scaled with them. And then we got there, we finally got up to the big leagues, and we got up to national plans. And now we're scaling through national health plans and larger systems.
Jeremy and I are doing the same thing. We hope to have 3 podcast viewers in the next month, yeah. And then maybe go up to 30. And then by next year, we're hoping that maybe 55.
Kieran's very modest.
So, for example, can I give you an example, and you can tell me how eConsult would work for this? So, you know, when you're pregnant, you go all the time, okay, to you have to go at the end, third trimester, you have to go to see somebody once a week. And all they're doing is checking for a heartbeat, and they're checking for, you know, to make sure that they measure your stomach to see if growth is going along the lines. But I remember I would have to take off work that day, right? I wasn't ill. I had to take off work. I would have to then commute. I would wait the doctor would see me, and he'd be like, yep, you're fine. And then I'd go back to work. That'd probably be 3 hours of lost productivity for my company. Yeah. And on and on and on. Now, there are some people who say that, you know, using either robotics or like a center where you could just literally go scan the thing, there'd be one person and, you know, that would immediately be sent to your office. Okay, are there ways or anything that has to do with monitoring a chronic condition? Pregnancy is not a chronic condition, but let's say also blood sugar. You have to go get your blood sugar measured, right, if you're a diabetic. How would eConsult help streamline that, or could they?
Before we go into the high-tech space, you gave an example, but you're probably very privileged in terms of access, right? You live in a place where you have specialists readily accessible. You can afford to go to them.
Even my friends who are on Medicaid, they still have to go to, they still have to show up at their local hospital, get checked out by an OBGYN, because that's one coverage they do mandate, for when you're pregnant through SCHIPS.
Yeah, so that's an area where we do a lot of work, which is we estimate that about 52% of the country has access challenges. That's when you put together rural plus Medicaid plus uninsured. And those are populations that really, really struggle to, access care. Maybe if they're lucky, they get access to primary care. And that's where we add value. They probably can't afford to go see, an OB often, because for them, you said your company lost in productivity. They may not be able to even take 3 hours of work if they're paid by the hours. Or that may mean
exactly
not bringing food to the table that night. So
it sounds like you're basically solving for the people who have the most immediate need. But I think, right, which of course makes sense, but I think that there's then that logical question of where can Rubicon MD go down the line? Like, what are other avenues that you see? I mean, not to give away the whole business plan, but what do you think are some of the things that I think a few years down the line we could be talking about, with respect to your work?
Robots.
Well, there are two things. We try not to talk about the robots taking over, but I think there are two areas that are focuses for us that we think over the next few years you'll see some really cool things happening. So one is, to use your example, you may not have needed to go see your OB for all of those visits, right? There are a number of things that could be monitored remotely.
Mm-hmm.
And that information could be uploaded through our platform, and
right,
we can get e-consults. You could communicate with your provider through telemedicine or all those things. This is kind of indicative of where healthcare is.
Right.
The idea that you would communicate with a provider via phone or video,
FaceTime.
That's innovative. Like, you could do that with your mom 10 years ago. It's not an innovative thing
because they're not getting paid for it. It goes back to the fee for service.
And if you create this framework that for value based care, you allow them to do those things, and you can use these remote monitoring devices, they can upload information to platforms like Rubicon MD, and we can service to provide opinions that support the readouts that you would get. And you don't need to travel for all of that. And so, yeah.
Well, the elephant in the room about this is one big hurdle has been, HIPAA laws and people saying that unless these, startups or whatever, medicine, unless they can prove that they're, unhackable, that all of this information, or that they're not subject to privacy issues. I still find it a false argument in this day and age, since we give all of our information, checking accounts, savings accounts. People can hack into the DMV, find your address. But a lot of people have this safety and security concern. How do you guys surmount that? And how do you guys ensure that if I am one of your, patients, or my primary care is using your service, that all these pictures of, me and, naked, I'm kidding, but like, don't get out there.
Yeah,
I don't even know how the pictures that of you naked are. Oh, I get it. Yes, for example, it's
like
a doctor that needs to see
like
you
what
naked.
If he takes a picture of.
Thought you meant it's like connected to your iCloud or
very
something.
Very funny, Jeremy.
Okay.
No, but like, what I'm saying. I mean, that would be the worst case scenario. But pretend you didn't want your boss to know you were suffering from a certain chronic condition.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you guys handle the security aspect?
This is a top priority. I mean, I mentioned this before. Before we could even operate, we had to make sure we had state-of-the-art technology that was fully HIPAA compliant. And every big group that we partner with, they want to go to a full security audit. They want to understand how we do it. They want to understand where the information is hosted, where, you know, where there's patient information, where there isn't. So this is a big part of the initial setup that we had to do. And as I said, it's not like, you know, you're starting a company, you want to get your MVP out, so you hack something together, put it out, and then you start iterating. We couldn't do that because we had to have a really robust infrastructure even before we could take the first patient information in the platform. So we this has been a priority since day one.
When I was at, I have moderated a few keynote panels at the Health Technology Forum, and what got people just riled up in the audience was, of course, when we talk about electronic medical records. And there are people who truly believe that this is like the beginning of the end, that the government is now going to be, you know, privy to every bit of personal information in our lives, which, like I said, I think they already are kind of, but one of the really interesting things that they discussed, which is bringing me in a very long roundabout way to what I was going to ask you, is that they said that no, it wouldn't say Jeremy Goldman and then his medical information. Everybody gets a number, like an access ID number, so that even if that information were to go out, they wouldn't know who they were talking about, right?
Yeah.
And so any provider or user of that service would have to know what Jeremy's, you know, it's like a WAP key on a computer. You'd have to know his hotspot. So what I'm asking is, have you helped facilitate other startups that are also trying to figure out ways to make healthcare more affordable and to be more streamlined through technology, such as perhaps using that company, I don't know the name, but, you know, to try to improve what you guys are building on?
Yeah, like learning from other people, and also just to build on that, like innovative companies that you're following and paying attention to in the space.
I think HIPAA is a little bit of a cop out around innovation.
Explain for people HIPAA too, because I'm worried that
for people who don't know
what are the HIPAA laws?
HIPAA is just a way of saying at the highest level that protected health information
health information privacy.
That your health information, things that identify you, needs to be kept secure.
Right, and only you have control over it.
You should have control over that information, and large corporations and other entities can't take that information and use it for nefarious purposes without you giving your consent. And so it's just a way to protect people and protect their information. And so I think you just have to be a responsible actor. And there are great companies to the point of, you know, that are people that are working in this space. There's a group called Aptible that's just set up just to streamline the process of setting up an application in a way that's HIPAA compliant. I think the bigger question and the, you know, the thing that people worry about is what happens if all the data gets out? What are the things that are coming down the pipe? And this is also to, you know, some of the things that we're thinking about in the 5-year plan for Rubicon MD. There's a great thing happening with digital health, which is that you have all these companies springing up that are, I think, building the right way. And so they're creating an ecosystem where you're using APIs, application programming interfaces, to actually connect to each other and to share information and to create an experience that mirrors the way you deal with other parts of your life. So you go on your mobile device and you can work on several apps and they connect to each other and you can order a ride and then you could play music and all of these things connect to each other. The way companies like us are building our infrastructure allows other people to leverage our APIs, allows us to connect to theirs, and allows us to build a seamless experience. And the ultimate beneficiary should be the patient for that. And so we think that's happening. Where this goes next, and some of the things we're working on, are what can we do with the data? So what we do to make sure that data is protected is we de-identify everything. And so we have a process and a structure where we'll de-identify information, take out all the patient's identifiable information, names, date of birth, mm-hmm. and we'll just aggregate it. But in aggregate, that data is really powerful because that data can tell you a lot of things about how things are being prescribed when certain conditions come up, and it can tell you now in the future what outcomes are tied to certain decisions. And we actually have data on the discussions and the decisions that are being made. And so we think that's really powerful as a first of its kind view as to how physicians dialogue. And so what we're looking at in the next stage is how can you provide that data back as a service to groups, and how can you allow primary care providers to have access to that information to be able to do the things that they need to do better with more information and bringing to bear to make more relevant information mm-hmm. to make decisions.
Gil, yes. I'm going to ask Gil first, then I'm going to ask Carlos. What would be your elevator pitch? Besides, you went to Harvard Business School, so I mean, you're obviously a smart cookie. But what would be your elevator pitch if you were trying to get more people to you know, pony up and help you guys?
Healthcare is 20% of GDP and growing. To solve those problems, you need to really think about how can you leverage technology to do things better, faster, cheaper. We're solving a piece of that puzzle by supporting primary care, which we think is the fundamental and foundational building block of healthcare. And we're building a company, which I think is something we're really proud of, that's doing it the right way. And we think we're building a great company with a diverse team, with great people, tons of awesome talent. And we want people to come join us along that ride.
I love it.
Carlos, yeah, also Harvard Business School.
I would totally subscribe to that. I would say that most of the tech solutions are really targeting a really small segment of the population and, you know, not solving a lot of basic needs. We're doing quite the opposite. We're finding populations who need a lot of help and solving a problem and having a lot of impact. And it is very important. When you're starting a company, some days are great, some days are really tough. But the one thing that we always have is you can look at the platform, look at the cases, and realize we are changing healthcare. We are changing people's lives.
I love it. Guys, thank you so much for your time. This is really informative and nerdy and heavy discussion, but I think it's an important discussion
right,
to be had.
So, I mean, nerdy and heavy until one of us gets a cold or one of us needs to go see a specialist.
Yeah,
right?
Stuff that we need to be thinking
really
about.
True.
So, but thank you very much for making the time. This
also,
is great.
And awesome. Also, people want to find out more about both of you and also about Rubicon MD. Tell us where we go.
RubiconMD.com. You can also find us on Twitter, Rubicon_MD or Gil Addo, or
Gil Addo and Carlos Reynes.
Reynes.
Okay, yep. I did a nye.
I love
okay. the R. Anyway, okay, Reynes. Great talking
find
to you too.
Thank
Good
you
luck
guys.
With everything.
Thank
we
you
need
guys.
It. We need it.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
And thanks to all of you for listening. You can subscribe on Stitcher or Apple Podcasts, and you can rate us on Apple Podcasts. And make sure to tell your friends, tell your family, tell your coworkers, tell your... Well, you get the idea. And until next time, this has been Future Proof.